Now you can think again.
Yes, I can.
Yes.
Well, the chipmunks in my head have been very busy.
Well, let's hear them.
I have chipmunks in my head. And they're clever. And I have to give them things to do.
Mm-hmm. They need their nuts.
They need a job. No, I was just remembering as we're talking about this, what I had read last night, that Jung compared the whole of the archetype to the spectrum of light. At the infrared end is the instinctual side where the archetype merges with biological processes. And at the ultraviolet end is the derived image, the spiritual side of the archetype. At this end of the spectrum, the anima, or animus, I guess you could say, is something quite different, as we shall see in the painting. This is Berghauser's painting. It is impossible to become conscious of the sense of an archetype known stresses just by indulging the instinct or drive, but only by seeing it from the ultraviolet end, for example, through active imagination or your dreams. Neither end is superior in a moral sense. Depending on the individual situation, the one aspect or the other is more appropriate. And that's what we've said.
Mm-hmm.
What page is that?
This is on page 61. valuable.
Mm-hmm. So you asked why infrared. I think because infrared is heat. And instinct is heat. Mm-hmm. I think that's why.
That's what I figured.
Yeah. Okay. Now, having done this, that is completely wrong. Because, or inadequate, because of synchronicity. Which is an image, but it's in matter. So, she says, he says, these two things really are a circle. And so, I know it doesn't make logical sense, but there's a point at which the image and the instinct meet. That is its essential nature, that they're one. But we tend to experience it as two different poles. But in the synchronicity, the real nature of the archetype surfaces because physical matter becomes symbolically important.
So is that kind of a one unus mundus kind of situation?
And that's a unus mundus.
Okay.
Yeah. Unus mundus is the fact that the material world can be in sync with us at a given moment when it operates symbolically. So inner, outer, matter, image, desire, meaning are all the same.
I wonder if it's always that way. And she talks about on 88 this means of reception.
Right.
And perhaps...
But hang on, let's make sure we got this before we talk about apprehending it.
Okay. Because I just wonder if the world always acts that way. But
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I don't know for sure.
Would it be like the wave and particle? It depends on the observer, which way you see it. Is that maybe part of it?
I would say more on the way it manifests. I think it manifests differently. Also, the word psychoid is just this. It's the word Jung gave for the fact that these two unite. Or maybe are intrinsically united, but we see them, if we don't see them in a synchronicity, we see them either as an instinct or as an image. But really their essence is that they're the same.
We see light is going in a straight line.
But right, but it actually is curved. Right. Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, all this was developed to explain how, when I can't say to explain, but one of the implications is it helps us understand how projections work where image and instinct work together. And what has astounded me, when the individual is ready to make a leap, and needs somebody to be with them or to help them, if not directly, indirectly, develop the personal qualities or skills necessary to complete the task, that person will show up. See what I'm saying? That's the synchronistic aspect of a projection. I think I told you the story about the guy, stop me if you remember, but the guy I worked with who just supercharged with libido, and I thought it's just a matter of time before he meets somebody. And then I knew a woman who was supercharged with libido, but I was thinking it's just a matter of time before she meets somebody. And the two of them met. Nothing to do with me. At a party. And I thought, jeez. So you see, we've got instinct, image, and synchronicity. And they often work together.
Can they work in a negative, destructive way as well?
I think you'd always have to keep that as an option. And, you know, in the case of that guy, he did not have an affair. And we worked with it. I knew about her free libido because I knew who else was involved with her, which wasn't satisfactory. So I wasn't working with her psychologically. I was working with him. And he did not have an affair with her. But made huge career changes out of what he realized through knowing her. And what was so interesting, then his wife, and they wanted to have another child, they did conceive another child.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think this all happened together. Yeah. His wife had then they had conceived another child, and he changed his career and loved his work. And she dreamt he was having an affair with the work. See how that works? So the image was his advance is shifting in a career. The instinct was his attraction to the woman. And the synchronistic aspect was that they met at a party.
And so what he did then was kept those instinctual responses inside himself to kind of cook in an alchemical
bottle. Right. Okay. Yeah. Now, to your destruction question, had he had an affair, it might have killed the marriage. Mm-hmm. They were kind of conservative. I don't think I'll be giving anything away today. That guy's a Jungian analyst. That's where it led him.
Wow.
Yeah. So you see how what power is involved in this. It completely changes life. And so instinct, so that's why she's going into all these, you might think, why in the world is she going through this? Because there are so many factors occurring together when we watch how people develop emotionally and spiritually that don't seem to go together. Why would you think image and desire and coincidence would have anything to do with each other? Well, we simply see that they do. And so they've tried to come up with a theory to explain that. And I think that was Burkhoizer's issue too. He was supercharged with libido. You got that impression? Yeah, it shows. Yeah. Whether he had an affair or not, I don't know. But his wife stayed with him. And her daughter wrote that book. Okay. So that's another paragraph. Then we got to Kathy's question. Means of reception on page 88. It's a big question whether the individual can hear what is required of them to integrate this process. In the case I told you, there was. I have also seen plenty of cases where there wasn't. I'm not sure why.
And what could be for one person, like the gentleman you talked about, needing to hold that all inside mm-hmm. yourself, for another person, you may need to act it out.
May need, yeah.
So we can't judge morally, no. like she says in there, one way or the other,
right.
what is the appropriate thing for that individual.
Right. But whether you act it or don't act it, the question is whether you can understand its meaning, I think.
Whether you can understand it.
Its meaning.
Oh.
We have a loose dog or something?
Slash dog on me. Oh my God, what? That's cute.
A dog?
Yeah. It looks like one of those labradoodles.
Oh. Standard
dog. Yeah.
Can we talk about the instinct? And
yeah. We got to learn it. What's it called, Homer?
Oh, did he?
Oh, of course. Why not?
That is too weird. I think that's... Oh, page 89. Just a couple of sentences to point out what's involved. One, the... first full paragraph, go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines. The whole experience can be falsely evaluated or distorted. See where I am there. That's one way to goof up on integrating. And it takes work, working at a genuine assimilation of his unconscious. That's where I went with the mendacity bit, the work required.
And this is on 89?
89 is first full paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 8, 8 and 10 lines down, falsely evaluated or distorted, and not working at a genuine assimilation.
So if you're caught by one or the other of them, instinct or image,
mm-hmm.
then you're not working on assimilation.
Right.
It becomes, like you said, autoeroticism because mm-hmm. you're just getting so much out of,
mm-hmm.
the ego is getting so much out of being stuck in one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we kind of covered a lot of the next chapter.
And I love what she says at the end.
Okay, let's read it.
Only in an inwardly open, naive attitude to the unconscious on the one hand, and an honest, conscientious, and painstakingly devotional on the part of the ego consciousness on the other can bring the creative contents of the unconscious matrix successfully over the threshold into consciousness. Play with neither plan nor purpose.
I love that too.
But to get to that place is not easy.
Right.
Somewhere along the way, I don't know how, through education, we lose our ability to play. We downplay.
Yeah.
The value of being able to play.
Yeah, that feeling of needing to be productive.
Exactly.
And
the energy
of working at 24/7.
I mean, there is a whole school of play therapy now, and the importance of trying to bring that back in.
Mm-hmm.
That's why dogs are so important. And they just love to play, and they
mm-hmm.
can, you know, you can be reminded. Playing with them, but
it just plays because it likes to play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, that's how I have a cat. And if I'm working on an image, I let the cat tell me what to do with this sort of laying on of paws. And when it comes up to me, it will like put its paw on my leg like this, and then I know I should just stop and pet the cat and just do something else for a while. And it seems to work rather well. So that, you know, that Unus Mundus idea, the cat seems to know when something should, there should be a pause.
A pause and pause.
Plus it, cats makes puns. Cat makes puns.
When you watch little kitties, they play, so, you know, you just put a string in front of them and they can just play for hours, you know. And,
you know, well, the cat's kind of a symbol for me, too, of doing what I really want to do. And which is what cats do, what they need.
Yeah. And what they need from you, at the moment.
Yes, they definitely demand what they want.
I know.
For 30 million. I know. Okay, polar nature of the unconscious. Well, we're then moving into this diagram, which we've already talked about. She gives just the historical background to this, saying that in antiquity or the Christian past, there was a discussion, do we understand, let's say, the Bible as primarily a historical record, that, you know, Jesus is Jesus, or do we understand Jesus as a symbol, Jesus as an image? And she said, Jung tries to resolve that duality in this concept of the archetype and the psychoid archetype, that experiences always contain both poles. An image, which would be the symbol, and an instinct, which would be the body reality of the experience. And then she talks about infrared and ultraviolet, that's page 90. See, we've done this. The 91, what she talks about is emotion. Another way to say this is it's the structure of an emotion. An emotion has both a physiological and a mental, symbolical aspect.
Well, she talks about aspects.
Same thing.
So she's not contradicting herself when she says archetype and instinct are the most polar opposites imaginable?
Where is that?
It's on page 90, that second paragraph. I guess she means an experience. And then she says, psychologically, they can flip one to the other. Extremes can meet and even change into their form.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess she's really talking about how we experience them. She doesn't really state it that way.
Well, it might have been more accurate to say archetypal image.
Okay.
And instinct.
Okay, very good. Thank you. The archetypes produce
instinct. Sometimes we need to experience one, and sometimes we need to experience the other to complement our conscious attitude. Thank you.
And then the next thing is the Unus Mundus. The next big thing, unless you got insight you want to look at in this succeeding paragraphs, the big thing is the Unus Mundus, which means one world, and it's a term she Jung took from The Alchemist. For that characteristic of the world, this is how I put it, that makes it possible for an inner emotion and outer person that carries the image, and the presence of that person, like those two people meeting at a party, to occur together. That is a unitary phenomenon. At that moment, we see there is an inherent oneness capacity built into life, built into the world. And when that happens, I think you can think, oh, I'm on the right track.
And so this is where instinct and image come together and form a symbol?
Yeah. Instinct, image, and the appearance of the person that carries that image all occurs together.
Okay. And that's the psychoid realm.
A psychoid is just a word to say
how that can happen.
How that happens, or that's a characteristic of the archetype that it does happen. The word psychoid is something he added much later when he realized how synchronicity is an image.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a person. It can be a synchronistic event.
Like right.
You dream about such and such, yeah. And then you go somewhere and there it is.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Right. But this convergence of emotion, understanding, and event, how they converge.
And then whether or not you can extrapolate the meaning from that depends on something else.
That's a whole other question.
You just have no idea why one person would get it and then the next person.
I sure don't. You know, the traditional understanding would be that the more damage in childhood, the more difficulty in apprehending this. But it has never been proven in my experience. I don't know why. But it sure is a good question. 92 is a diagram.
I couldn't make heads or tails of that diagram.
Thank you.
Well, it's the same thing as I put up there.
If you're seeing the circle as the ray of light, and a light ray, it has an infrared aspect and an ultraviolet aspect, spirit and matter, and then they come together in the smooth. That's what I got from it, maybe.
Well, let me see. Yeah. But I want to correct myself. It's not exactly what I have up there. Where is it? No, it's not.
Mm-mm. She calls it the roving light ray of the ego
consciousness.
Quite interesting.
Yeah. Nothing to do with rove versus. Okay. I'll try to put it up there. See if we can. She's just added another element.
She called it a scale of psychic processes. I might call it a field.
Let's see.
Because once you have the roving idea, you sort of...
I'm going to just change it a little bit. No, she doesn't like this thing.
Yeah, it's ego consciousness.
Yeah. All she's done is taken my diagram and added ego consciousness to it. So, this would be the archetype. And this would be the instinctual pull. And this, this would be the image pull.
Well, see, that's how it, people get confused in their mind. Because the image can be, the instinct can be image too. So it's more like the, she has the instinctual versus the archetypal pull.
She has.
Well, that's yeah.
Image. Yeah, I would say the archetypal image.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
She's using the word archetype here to mean image, I believe.
Well, but prior she says that, you know, instinct is expressed by image.
Well, she's contradicting. I mean, she's.
Well, I mean, she's elaborating. She's not really contradicting.
Her words aren't used consistently.
Right.
And why does she call Venus and Linda blatant content? I guess I get a little confused about that.
Well, so this is, remember how I sort of said, well, here are the two poles and they meet. This is where they meet.
Mm-hmm.
That's the psychoid.
That's the synchronicity, right?
Well, that's then in their mind, the nature of any content of the personality is that it's both physical and psychological.
Okay.
So that when it tries to become, I could call that a cycle, or I could just call that a complex, because a complex has a cycloid nature. And so when it's about to become conscious, it will go that way. It'll split up into an image and an instinct. Though we talked about those situations where it doesn't, it probably does that, but we don't see the other side of it. I think it's safe to say it always happens, though we may only perceive. And so this then is the perceiving mechanism that registers what's happening. And our consciousness should both pick up that we're energized psychologically, emotionally, and that you be asking what its meaning is. So let's say in communism, Nazism, all they did was, they didn't do this. All they did was that, which allowed this absolute free reign. So, Hitler really, I think, wanted to create a better world. Except he forgot he was murdering 50 million people. You might say Janis Joplin did this. All she had was instinct. She was just living with as much emotional intensity as possible till she died. And never asked, what's the meaning of what I'm experiencing? So if you're living the instinct without the meaning, you think by getting more instinct, you're getting more meaning, but you're not. You're just getting more instinct. And you burn up. So the consciousness, in the best of all possible worlds, should perceive both sides.
When she talks about that Venus Linus being latent, I think she means not always available to consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe not even present.
Not even a factor at the moment.
Yeah.
Or the principle isn't engaged in the process,
yeah.
Or activated.
You know, there are, I don't think you'll hear them in standard Jungian circles, but sort of the New Age take on Jung is that there's synchronicity all the time. And it's always happening. Mm-hmm. And whatever happening is meant to be.
Yeah.
I was working with somebody like that, and then it turned out that her daughter was molested by her boyfriend. I said, now, was that meant to be?
Well,
see what I mean? That's where it breaks down.
The meant to be thing is really sort of a Christian thing, right? It's God's plan.
Maybe. But what I'm trying to say is, not every event is synchronistic. Sometimes there are just events. And this, I think, is activated only at certain points.
So where I was getting confused is it sounds like the aspect of the Venus Mundus maybe it has to be recognized as such, like there's a synchronicity when it's recognized as such, or you're attracted to someone and then you look at the underlying meaning of it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a latent thing to be there, but it can only really, it has to be perceived.
Well, it has to occur. I don't think it always occurs. Not every event is a synchronistic event.
And so I guess I'm confused because it sounds like on the one hand this dual nature only happens, you know, with synchronicities and things like that, but then sometimes it sounds like it's always dual nature, so I'm getting confused.
Well, the potential is always there, but it doesn't always surface.
The dual aspect.
Dual aspect, yeah. Again, I think where we get stuck is we are so used to Newtonian thinking. And the fact that something can occur just because it occurs is hard for us to grasp. But think of the Geiger counter. Those things occur at certain random moments. And at certain random moments, this becomes a reality. Otherwise, it's a potential.
But if we look back on it from our future,
yeah,
then we can see that had...
There was something going on there.
Some kind of organizing...
Yes.
Factor going on.
So, I mean, this is a little bit chaos theory in a way. You see, these look chaotic. They are statistically chaotic, yet average, they're not.
Right.
It makes no logical sense. But if physical reality can be that way, why can't psychological reality be that way? This is a shift we got to make in our head.
You know, at some point, something I read where she talked about as consciousness lights up one area, everything else turns black.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think of how that comes in, that when you focus on one area, if you focus on it too much, I mean, you can control your consciousness and what you're looking at. If you're not being aware that everything else is dark, then you can get really into a problem.
Mm-hmm. So I'll one. Okay.
Ninety-one, second full paragraph. And the last sentence.
The last two sentences.
Yeah. Be back.
Yeah, I just think that means if you're working on that complex, then you're not working on other complexes.
But I was thinking that maybe sometimes you're so focused on the instinct or the image.
That could also be. Yeah, but I think here she says, those affects lift one content, which occupies the forefront of consciousness, into supernormal clarity. But at the same time, darken the rest of the field of consciousness. This brings about a lowering of the orientation to the external world and therewith a relativization of time and space. So that when you're working on one thing, you can't be working on something else. If you work on one thing intensely, there's more likely... I know I'm contradicting myself, but there's more likely a synchronicity will occur while you're working on it than while you're not working on it. I think that's what she's saying.
Well, that sort of goes along with the idea of physics, where some physicists are beginning to look at consciousness as a factor in the universe, not simply a result of the physical brain.
And if you look at energy, that makes sense, because if you're concentrating on something, you're putting an enormous amount of energy out there, and that...
And when they're saying that, you know, consciousness is perhaps a principle out in the universe.
Right. And that has to be the case.
Like a force.
And see, that contradicts emergence theory, which is part of the science of complexity. Because in emergence, consciousness is simply an emergent property of the physical brain. Consciousness is not outside
of
the brain.
Well, that's clearly wrong.
Well, that's how, if you follow the idea of emergence, or that specialized part of complexity, which is emergence, if you follow that, it contradicts those ideas in physics and in Jungian thought.
I would agree with that. My understanding of emergence is that we can't project the emergence of these things, good or bad. They are unpredictable. So I think the way it is, I agree with you that the way that a lot of people think about consciousness is the emergent property of just the brain. But I don't think there's anything in emergence theory, or in complexity theory, that would indicate that. I think that's the way they have.
Well, that is their definition. That's the people who are working in these theories, that's their definition.
I didn't get that when I was reading about emergence.
Well, that's what I read. I think I have the name of the scientist down, but a neuroscientist, that was his explanation of how emergence relates.
Yeah, that's got to be wrong.
But he's a neuroscientist, but if you look at just complexity theory at the very basics of it, emergence does not.
Well, he was also a scientist working in complexity theory.
Because remember the ant example I told you? You put 20 ants here. I have a little crack in another table with food over here. The 20 ants will run around until they die.
Mm-hmm.
But 10,000 will build a bridge. So consciousness is not in the ant. It's something shared among the ants.
Right, and emergent theory thinks that consciousness is a property of the brain.
Yeah, well, that ant instinct contradicts that.
Right. There are people out there who try to compare emergent theory and archetypal theory and say, well, they're compatible.
I think they are very compatible.
Well, and that's how they're not.
But the archetype could be among those ants.
As far as Jungian theory talks about what consciousness is, and that the archetype can be outside of us,
yeah,
operating in matter,
yeah,
emergent theory denies
that.
Yeah, effect.
That's the difference. I'm going with the ant. I don't know if all convergence says that consciousness has to be tied to the brain.
Well, that is what you hear from the scientists who are studying emergent theory.
Really?
Yeah, this is not what you hear from people who are trying to tie the two theories together of archetypal theory and emergence. They ignore that.
See, the guy that I listened to those tapes, he was a social scientist. He was an economist. So he's looking at consciousness building up from, he started as an economist and then got into complexity theory. So he's looking at how when you have a group, suddenly something new comes up. You know, nobody ever had silly putty in the history of the world, but because of the way, you know, people interact, somehow that people that had ideas about these things came up with them. And silly putty is a silly example, but I think a neuroscientist is looking at complexity theory in a different way. And
this fellow wasn't just a neuroscientist.
I know, but I'm guessing, and I don't know, that he started out in neuroscience and then went to complexity theory, just like this guy started out, because complexity theory is so new. This guy started out in social sciences and went into complexity theory. So their background, complexity theory covers all kinds of different things. So the background you came into it would determine how you thought.
Well, what this fellow is saying is that the theory of emergence states that. It's not his opinion of emergence. This is what he said. He said that emergence states that.
States what?
That the brain, that consciousness is an emergent factor.
And consciousness is an emergent factor of the brain. All the neurons, each individual neuron does not have consciousness, but consciousness is an effect of all the neurons working together. But that does not say that all kinds of other things working together could not become conscious.
Well, what this has to do with this, in any case, is we have to assume that something outside ourselves has an intelligence, as exampled in that woman and that man meeting each other at a party. That's where it's important. So that we don't think consciousness is limited to the brain. Or the brain might be everywhere, if you want to say it's limited to the brain. That the brain is not only inside us. So anyway. But it's worth pondering, because we are forced to change all our assumptions about the nature of consciousness. Consciousness cannot only be a human phenomenon. It has to be, if we take synchronicity seriously, it has to be residing somewhere else. And that would be the psychoid aspect of the archetype. We are actually getting toward the end of the chapter. So unis modus is okay.
Marginally.
Unis modus for president. Well, I always remember this time when I was teaching English in Switzerland, and we were discussing the subjunctive, I think. People just looked at me. I said, "Do you understand?" "No." "Are you confused?" "Yes." And somebody said, "But I'm confused on a higher level." You might just at least realize that there are terms that fit together that don't normally fit together, which is emotion, seeing something in the outer world, image, the presence of a person who represents, who carries what you're seeing, magically appearing, quote unquote, at that time when you are needing to see them, and the idea that this apparent chance event is more than a chance event. That's what we're trying to explain. And I don't think you need to worry about all the details of the theory, just how all of these elements fall together. And they fall together in a way which the average person would dismiss as having any relationship with each other. But Jung is saying, whoa, these things have a relationship with each other.
So synchronicity needs to be the body.
Right? Yeah. Well, yes. Actually, this is sort of an inadequate diagram, because synchronicity would be when these two things converge.
Okay.
And the ego can perceive all three.
What are some other things that can be that with other people can see?
I think that's it. An emotion or an instinct,
mm-hmm.
a something I'm seeing,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that the person appears mm-hmm. when that sight is ready to see, so that these two combine and I perceive it.
And can extract the meaning.
And then the question is that, I think most of the time, if you can admit these three things are occurring together, you will interpret it. Except for mendacity, maybe. That you might see it and just say, "I don't care."
Right. Because on number three, she gets into this idea of attribution of that experience.
Right.
And there's another place where we can get tripped up.
Right.
Is,
a wrong attribution.
Right.
Or just failing to even want to, failing to deal with it whatsoever, which can lead to loss of soul.
Right. So that the two dangers are, what does she say?
Page 93.
Saying, I am divine because this event happened. That would be identifying with the event. You get a psychotic person might feel that the reason, let's say that guy were psychotic. A psychotic person might say, well, that just shows that I'm Jesus Christ because she appeared. Or, so that would be identifying with it. And the other would be saying, well, it has nothing to do with me. Both of them are errors. In the one case, you get inflated. And I would imagine in the latter case, in time, you would get depressed. Because a new opportunity has been given to you, you don't take it up, and life grinds to a halt. You see how that guy's life changed as a result of that woman's presence in his life. So that revitalized his professional feeling of satisfaction.
And that is a numinous experience.
Yes.
Correct. That has importance, and you can either identify with that numinosity.
Right.
Get it into yourself.
Right.
Or you can just dismiss it as unimportant.
Right.
And so then, with that, it fizzles out.
Right.
Its capacity to enliven life mm-hmm. and just fizzles.
Ironically, it fizzles out both ways. Well, in the former, you're elated before you fall. Okay. And in the second, you've already fallen.
Okay. Either way, you're going to be disappointed.
Either way, you're going to run into a brick wall. Or the police. Yeah, I'm serious.
Yeah. So, with Nietzsche, he identified with the numinous experience.
Right.
And eventually...
That's a perfect example.
And eventually just lost everything.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that then the ego consciousness, that means a healthy ego that can reflect on the experience, is so necessary.
Right.
In being able to attribute the right meaning to the event.
Right. Okay. In our jargon, sufficient shadow has to have been integrated before this can be entertained. Definitely. We didn't get quite through. We didn't do too bad. We got through to 93. Where did we start? So about 10 to 15 pages a meeting, you might figure. What she turns to, we're going to stop, but just to set the stage. She's going to turn to just this problem now. What? Now that we have talked about projections, now that we have examined what it is that has been projected, we're going to talk about what's it mean to integrate the projection. And she's going to turn to myth and fairy tales as a guide. And the next chapter we're going to look at is what is it like when the projection cannot be integrated? And for that, she's going to look at fairy tales of demons. So that's, I'm just trying to keep the thread alive for you that we don't get lost in all the details. So the next chapter will be looking at stories of demons and what do you do if the complex that is being projected is too big for you to integrate at the particular moment. How do you cope with it? How do you recognize it? How do you deal with it in your life? Then the next chapter will be then where you can integrate it and how it can guide you. But she'll go to the difficult chapter first. So I think I had you read to 107. 110. I don't think we'll get past that.
Demons
are big ones. Yeah. Well, I don't think you need to read anything else.
I think the evil demons that catch Shadow and Evil in fairy tales, I think some of theirs are in Shadow and Evil.
Some of these fairy tales. Well, if you want to just make notes and amplify with what you've read in there, please feel free. Okay? Everybody still sane?
Or insane on a high level.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like Hollis's book about questions, and he says, I don't have any answers for you. I just have more questions. And I think that there is some truth in that. It's when you get more confused, but sometimes you're actually at a higher level because you're... When you've decided you've got it all pegged, that's when you're usually not very clear on anything.
But half the problem is asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm. And leaving room for doubt. You know, they're not just so sure that this is how it is. So doubt can really, that's why doubt was so powerful. You know, if you can leave that door open, something new can come in.
It makes your life a lot harder. It's a lot easier to be quite sure of yourself.
Absolutely. And then you're inflated, and that leads to a downfall anyway. So there you go.
I don't know. A lot of people have been inflated for an awfully long time doing just fine.
Well, that's because they're held within the way the world is working.
They may be creating havoc for everybody else, but
they're happy.
They're happy. So, yeah, they're happy. Okay. They just don't see you.
Because they're so sure that the havoc that they are creating is actually created by the people who are receiving it themselves.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for hanging in there.